Greetings. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Arthur Shapiro. Dr. Arthur Shapiro is a distinguished professor of evolution and ecology at the University of California, Davis. He is the author of about 300 scientific publications and has mentored 17 PhDs in his 42 years at UC Davis. Dr. Shapiro studies the evolutionary ecology and biogeography of butterflies in Western North America, the Andes, and Patagonia. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Arthur Shapiro.
Well, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay? I'm going to do something unusual. My neighbor across the street died a few days ago, and my commitment to be here today makes it impossible for me to attend the memorial service, so I'd like to dedicate these remarks to my deceased neighbor, Steve Warnock in Davis. And with that, we will begin. The American humorist Artemus Ward, back in the 19th century, observed, "It ain't what we don't know that gets us in trouble. It's what we know that ain't so." I'm going to talk about the ecological community and some concepts of the community that we think we know and that get us into trouble. And I will begin by showing you this devilishly handsome fellow, who is Frederick Clements, who is the author of many of the most familiar concepts of ecology that virtually all of us got in school. He is, in effect, the father of the community concept. He is the father of the concept of ecological succession and climax. He coined the word climax as a contraction of the words climatic maximum. And he was a holist. He believed that ecological communities were real entities that were functionally integrated, that the component species were analogous to the organs of your body. Now, in a group this size, I'm sure there are a few of you who no longer have a gallbladder. And you're still alive and kicking. You can get along without a gallbladder. I hope there's no one in the room without a brain. Okay. Clements recognized that some species were more important in the community than others. But he did insist on this superorganism concept of the community to drive home the interdependence of the species making up the community. And he was not actually original on this. Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverer of natural selection with Charles Darwin, based on his extensive experience in the tropics and the intimate interdependence of species that he observed both in the American and the Old World tropics, came to a similar conclusion and wrote about how if you removed any component in a complex ecological system, you potentially would set off ripples that would destabilize the entire system. Okay, Clements, as I say, shaped the concepts of community ecology that dominated in American ecology and in academe, and in particular in environmental education. And even today, most kids who are taught about communities learn about the Clemencian community. But by no means were Clemens's points of view shared by everyone. This man, who is considerably less of a stud, was Henry Gleason. And Gleason was the great intellectual antagonist of Clemens through much of their careers. Gleason is the father of what has been called the individualistic concept of the Interspecific Association. Gleason argued that every species, by virtue of its unique history, ecologically, evolutionarily, biogeographically, had its own unique properties. And it was naive to assume that species would fit together in the intimate way conceived by the Clemencians. He basically argued that what we call a community is the set of species that co-occur in space and time, and by virtue of their individual properties are able to persist and interact at that space and time. In other words, a community is not a tightly integrated thing with a long-term history. A community is, in a sense, an accident. Okay. A little bit of history. How did the Clemencian community come about, if it's real? The glue that would hold together that kind of community was visualized as coevolution. Now, if you happen to be a creationist, you can attribute it to the wisdom and benevolence of the Creator, and I won't argue with you about that. But if you are a Darwinian or a neo-Darwinian, you might well argue that by virtue of long-term intimate association, species evolve in response to one another and develop interdependencies. We call that coevolution. In the 1960s, Paul Ehrlich from Stanford and Peter Raven from the Missouri Botanic Garden published a very famous paper on butterflies and plants, a study in coevolution, in which they traced the host plant specializations of butterflies, which we already knew. There were already inklings of this as early as 1910, were very largely grounded in what is called secondary plant chemistry, the chemicals that make plants interesting, that make horseradish taste like it does, that make onions smell like they do, that make marijuana do what it does. Okay, those chemicals, which are associated with particular plant lineages, form the basis for host selection, both egg-laying by females and feeding by caterpillars. They argued for integration of such multi-species associations by coevolutionary relationships. The time was right for that idea, and it caught on. And coevolution was very widely embraced as the glue that tied communities together. My undergraduate advisor at the University of Pennsylvania was Robert MacArthur. Those of you who are ecologically savvy will recognize his name. Robert MacArthur, who had been the protege of the great limnologist G. Evelyn Hutchinson, was the person who revolutionized ecology in the English-speaking world in the 1960s by fostering a method of mathematical and graphical modeling that sought to bring elegance, deductive elegance, into the very messy mass of ecological data accumulated in centuries of natural history. Okay? Now, One consequence of the MacArthur approach was an increasing emphasis on what came to be called assembly rules of communities, the ways that species could or could not fit together to form communities. And that was intimately related to the idea of character displacement, which was the idea that species in competition for resources would develop evolutionarily differences in their use of resources, become increasingly divergent from one another in resource use, become more specialized to remove the competition. This can result in getting more species into ecological space. We call that species packing. And it was used as an explanation of the higher biodiversity in the tropics as against higher latitudes, which was a great preoccupation of community ecology at that time. Okay, so far everything fits together very well. The mathematical models that these folks were developing typically entailed an assumption of equilibrium at the end. That greatly simplifies the mathematics. But a lot of practicing natural historians, particularly out here on the West Coast, where MacArthur ecology was not eagerly accepted at Berkeley, for example, thought the world is much messier and much more complicated than that. Based on their own experience, the notion that multi-species systems evolve to an equilibrium seem to be a fanciful oversimplification. Okay, another influence in my intellectual development was the late Robert H. Whitaker, community ecologist, who in many ways was a follower of Gleason in his approach to the quantification of ecological communities. And he proposed that if we could quantify interspecific association on a scale from -1 to +1 and develop a pairwise matrix of all the species in a community, filling in the cell with a number between -1 and +1 to indicate the nature of their interaction, -1 meaning they cannot coexist, +1 meaning they must coexist, they're interdependent, and 0 meaning they have no effect on each other at all. He proposed that for a large ecological community, you would get a bell-shaped curve with the mean, median, and mode at 0, and a small subset of very highly negative interactors and a small subset of very highly positive interactors. And the positive interactors and perhaps also the negative interactors would be products of coevolution. Are you following me okay? Okay. Well, some more concepts that came along. Niche conservatism seemed to be the opposite of character displacement. The observation that closely related species tended to do the same kind of thing in the same way. This was an outgrowth of studies of species to genus ratios in communities, a line of endeavor that began actually in the 19th century, but is usually attributed to the English ecologist Charles Elton, in which you find that for small geographic areas, you typically get only 1-point-something species per genus. But as you make a larger geographic area, that number goes up because closely related species tend to replace one another geographically and not to coexist in the same place. Okay, but at the same time, there were many evolutionary studies showing incredibly close fine-tuning of species to one another and to their environment on a local basis. How could you reconcile niche conservatism on the one hand and fine-tuning on the other? John Thompson, an evolutionary ecologist now at UC Santa Cruz, helped to clarify this with his concept of a geographic mosaic of coevolution. Okay, remember that Gertrude Stein said, I'm not going to give the quote about Oakland. She said, a rose is a rose is a rose. But Thompson would counter that by saying, a rose in Oakland may not be the same thing as a rose in San Francisco. That is, coevolution and community fine-tuning can occur on a local scale, such that interspecific relationships may differ spatially. Okay? So both things are potentially capable of being accommodated. Cladistics is both a philosophy and a method of classification, and I won't belabor it, just to say that when cladistics caught on, it provided a way to test the Ehrlich and Raven coevolution hypothesis, proceeding from the null hypothesis that speciation of one component of an ecological system either would or would not cause speciation in the interactor. There were numerous tests of this idea. It typically failed, and the reason it failed was because it was a straw man in the first place. Nobody really believed it would succeed. Okay, well, where does all of this take us? It takes us to Dan Jansen. Dan Jansen is perhaps the most famous tropical ecologist. But before I give you a quote from Jansen, let me give you a quote from me. I'm not a famous tropical ecologist, but okay. I've been teaching a course in community, the community concept now, for 40-some years. It was first taught in 1974, and the heart of the course is this exam question at the top. I'll read it to you. If communities are real, one should be able to distinguish between a genuine co-evolved community with a lengthy history and geologic time versus a recent assemblage of adventive species with no significant history of interaction. Assuming one has no taxonomic or biogeographic knowledge to clarify such issues, but is a sophisticated community ecologist, how would one go about telling for a given putative community? Or can it really be done? Reason tightly in a Popperian mode. In other words, your goal is to falsify a hypothesis. Do not wave your arms to the point of exhaustion. Okay, I have been using that question as a test of how much the students learned in the course. So remember it. If we have time, I'll hand it out to you and you can write an essay at the end of this talk. Okay, Dan Jansen. I'm not going to read all of this to you, and you don't have to read it either. I will just tell you what it says. Dan Jansen is probably the most accomplished tropical ecologist working in the New World. He has an extremely fecund brain and has come up with many very important ideas over the years. He has a gift for presenting them outrageously and provocatively. And one of his ideas is called ecological fitting, and it's pure Gleasonian ecology. He argues that there is no a priori reason why we should assume just because a multi-species system seems to work that it is co-evolved. That it is the product of the species adapting to one another in geologic time. There is no reason to assume a priori without historic knowledge that it hasn't arisen as a fortuitous byproduct of species coming together whose Gleasonian properties fit. Okay? You may believe that the person you're married to is your soulmate and that your match was made in heaven. I've been married now since 1969. I might be tempted to believe that, but I also believe in historical contingency. And I know that had it not been for the fact that in those days, graduate students needed a lot of Xeroxing done. I would not have gone into a certain copy shop in downtown Ithaca, New York, and met the very cute female who was usually behind the counter to receive your materials, and whom I subsequently married. Okay, maybe it was arranged by the angels, but how can we be sure? Okay. Here's an extended quote from Mark Sagoff in a book called Invasive and Introduced Plants and Animals, which is highly recommended, who just says the same thing that Jansen just said. He says it very nicely, and I'll just read the first paragraph aloud. The theory that evolutionary processes structure ecosystems and endow them with a mathematical organization, that is, rule-governed patterns that ecologists can study, has the following implication. Scientists should be able to tell by observation whether a given ecosystem is heavily invaded or remains in mint condition. I will argue that we have no algorithm for making that distinction. We need to know actual history in order to assess whether an apparent community is a community in the Clementsian sense, with a long history of coevolution, integration, functional determinism, or whether it is a community in the Gleasonian sense, thrown together and by trial and error working out to be a system that is self-perpetuating, at least in the term of our observation. You may remember that one Greek creation myth has the gods creating all the parts of animals, feet, tongues, eyeballs, tails, and then throwing them together randomly, and the ones that worked together well persisted and the others went extinct. A Gleasonian perspective on the community would suggest that communities are often like that. And Jansen, who works in the tropics just as Alfred Russel Wallace did, has a very different take on this from Wallace. He says all the time he sees things in the tropics that have the stamp of contingency, that he believes, for good reason, are not the product of long-term coevolution, but are the product of relatively recent perturbation. And that takes us to the second half of this talk, which is the part that has data. Okay, we all know that climates change. We all know that the planet undergoes more or less dramatic changes in its face, in continental position, mountain building, erosion, deposition, you name it. So here is a long-term climate timeline, going back to the beginning of the tertiary at least. But we're not going to worry about a time frame quite that long. We could talk about the plant communities that were around in the Pennsylvanian and the Permian when coal seams were being put down, but since none of those plants is still around today, we needn't worry about them. I'd rather think about the plant communities that we know, that we grew up with, and how long they've been around and how much they've changed. So let's take a shorter time frame. So here we are just since deglaciation, since the end of the last glacial epoch, which was somewhere between 10 and 20,000 years ago, depending on where you are, and if you happen to be in the Antarctic or Greenland, it's not quite over yet, although it's rushing to come to an end. Okay, the point is climate has been all over the place. And it's been all over the place in historic time as well, so that we have not only proxy records of various kinds, we also have historical documentation for the Little Ice Age, for the medieval warm period, blah, blah. And we know that those things had impacts on the distributions of organisms. Here's an even finer time frame graphic. Showing just the past 1,000 years, how much climatic variation there has been. We are all, I think, preoccupied with the climatic change that's going on around us right now and what its biological and ecological and human consequences are going to be. And as is so often the case, the past can be the key to understanding not only the present but the future. So if we're interested in whether communities are real, and whether they are resilient through space and time, we need to look back at the history of communities, and that's what I'm going to do for the next few minutes. Okay, how many of you have pollen allergies? Lots. Well, pollen turns out to be immensely valuable for what we are talking about. Some of you I know about this, and some of you I assume do not, so let me take a couple of minutes to explain. We're talking about wind-dispersed pollen now because animal-vectored pollen is too sticky and heavy to leave the kind of signature that we're talking about. But plants that are pollinated by wind, how many here have a deodar cedar on the property? Anybody? Deodar is the heaviest pollinating ornamental tree we have in California. Different species of trees produce different volumes of pollen. Deodar really fills the air with pollen. Okay. Trees, of course, are not the only contributors to wind-blown pollen. Many herbaceous species do. Grasses are wind-pollinated. Okay. Well, what happens to pollen grains? Well, you have all seen a more or less circular ring of yellow by the curb. That's pollen. It's pollen that settled on a puddle, and then the puddle dried up, leaving a deposit of pollen. Pollen that falls into bodies of water, lakes, bogs, settles by gravity to the bottom and gets incorporated into sediment. Pollen grains have an outer coating that makes them very resistant to decay. They also have distinctive morphologies, such that you can identify plants by the morphology of their pollen grains as recovered from lacustrine or bog sediment. Okay, do you see where this is going? Well, I'll tell you where it's going. Where it's going is you can take a core down through the sediment at the bottom of a body of water. I went to Cornell, and Cornell happens to have a wildlife preserve called the McLean Boggs Preserve. They're what's known as kettle hole peat bogs. They've been there since the glaciers receded about 13,000 years ago, give or take a few years. It's 40 feet down from the top of the bog to bedrock. The bogs are filled with vegetable peat and sediment. So we know that 40 feet of sediment accumulated in 14,000 years, give or take a little. They've been cored. You take a core down through, you extract it. You take slices in the core. You identify the pollen grains, which are usually identifiable at no finer level than genus and sometimes only family. The finer the identification taxonomically, the better for our purposes. So you identify them qualitatively, what species or genera are there, and quantitatively, what's their relative abundance, and you date the matrix they're embedded in using isotopic dating methods. And what have you got? You've got a proxy record, probably continuously distributed, that's testable, over several thousand years of what the vegetation was. And if you know the climatic adaptation of those plants, you can use them as a proxy for the paleoclimates in which they grew. Now, for those of you who are really clever or already know this stuff, you know there are many levels at which the data have to be massaged and interpreted. For example, some plants produce much heavier quantities of pollen than others. Some of the pollen goes further. Sometimes there's seasonal variation in wind direction, which can affect the pollen deposition, blah, blah, blah. We can talk about that in the question period. The point is that from data of this sort, we get stuff like this. These are pollen spectra by plant groups. This happens to be from a place called Castiglione, Italy. Okay? So the higher the curve, the more abundant that pollen taxon is. Some of them come and go. Some of them are continuously present. But if we know the climatic adaptation, we can recognize when it was cold, when it was warm, when it was wet, when it was dry. There are thousands of such records from all over the planet, both in temperate latitudes like Italy, and tropical ones. This is from El Valle, Panama. The Panamanian, Guatemalan, and so forth, Mexican records are particularly interesting because they show an interplay of temperate and tropical plants as the climate waxed and waned during the Quaternary. Okay? Now, it may be occurring to you, can we translate these interspecific associations documented by fossil pollen into communities? And the answer is, if we are willing to exclude the animal-pollinated taxa, yes. Again, we have to do various levels of interpretation. Let me show you some very interesting data from the UK. Different species of trees. Okay, 90-some percent of the British Isles was glaciated in the Pleistocene and had no vegetation. Only a little bit in the southwest was not glaciated. Okay. By the date when pollen signatures appear in the record, we can reconstruct the sequence of colonization of Britain by these trees from the continent. And here they are. So you see Betula, which is birch, came first, then hazel, then elm, then oak, then pine, blah, blah, blah. And the most recent one to arrive is Fagus, which is beech, which only got there about 3,000 years ago and is still increasing. Okay? This suggests that different species migrate at different rates. Whole communities don't travel together. Species travel in a Gleasonian way, composing themselves into communities depending on what is where, when. Okay, we have such extensive data in the East, not here, but in the East, that we have these wonderful maps. You all know what an isobar is. It's a line on a weather map that connects places with the same barometric pressure. These are isopalms, pal as in pollen. They connect places where things arrived at the same time. Okay, so the dates on there, 13, 12, 11, 10,000 years ago, up to 4,000 up there along the U.S.-Canadian border. It shows when that species migrated in after deglaciation. Okay, we've got maple at the upper left, hickory next to it. We have beech at the lower left, and chestnut, may it rest in not quite peace, at the lower right, and we can see those maps are not congruent. Things migrated in different ways from different refugia at different rates. And so their ranges intersected at different times. Here are a few more. We've got lots of these folks. Okay, so here we have some conifers. And then we have a few more deciduous trees on the right. Okay, I think the point is plain. Whole communities do not migrate as communities. Interspecific associations, as a rule, do not migrate as interspecific associations unless they are obligatory. If they are mutualists that require each other, for example, anybody here know what mycorrhizae are? Yeah. Yes, sir, tell us. They are fungi, soil fungi, that interact with the roots of higher plants. And in many cases, the higher plant cannot become established without the interaction with the fungus. So the fungus has to be in the soil for the plant to become established. So in that case, the fungus may get there first, but the plant can't get there first. It requires the fungus. Okay, so mandatory associations may have to travel together, but most associations, remember Whitaker, are not mandatory. Okay. This is kind of flabbergasting. This is a reconstruction for Europe. Okay, the areas with vertical shading are glaciated. Various times from 13,000 years ago to 1,000 years ago, the areas with diagonal shading have no analog communities. That means the plant association documented in the pollen record in those areas at those times does not exist today. It's a set of species which came together contingently at that time and formed a community. And if you grew up in that community in Westphalia, you would think, oh, sure, that's the community in Westphalia. It always has been, it always will be, but it's not. I like to put it this way. Communities as we understand them are stills taken out of a movie. Okay? If we look at one scene in Some Like It Hot, and Marilyn Monroe is doing something, that tells us nothing about the plot, does it? And to make the point again, here's the distribution of vegetation zones on the Colorado Plateau at the time of deglaciation versus now. You notice the letters on the two sides are different. They're different because none of the same associations occur at both times. They're different associations. Okay. Time to blow your mind again. Okay. The vertical shading gives the modern distribution of the wood turtle. The horizontal shading gives the modern distribution of the southern toad. The black dot is a place where the two co-occurred 10,000 years ago in Georgia. Their ranges do not overlap anywhere today, but they were able to coexist in Georgia under the conditions at that time. Now, you may think, oh boy, that's sort of like scouring the Bible for a verse to support your hatred of strawberries. Nope. Oodles of them. Here are more examples. In each case, the big round dot is a place where species are associated at a point in time they are never associated today. Ranges have changed incredibly. You've heard of Hadrian's Wall, where the Emperor Hadrian built a wall to keep the savage Celts out? Okay, when they were building that wall, his engineers had camps and they had garbage tips, which had been excavated by archaeologists. They're full of beetle remains that are no longer found in the British Isles today. You have to go to Lapland to find them. Okay? That's a pretty short time frame. Well, I have a few more of those. I won't bother you with them. Let me just say, Paleo beetles give us another kind of perspective, because beetles can fly and trees can't. Beetles, as long as they're not dependent on a specific plant community, and scavengers and carnivores generally are not, can colonize behind a retreating glacier faster than plants can. When we get beetle remains along with the pollen, you know what they tell us? They tell us trees take 50 or 100 years to leave a pollen signature. You have to get a sufficient number of them colonizing. They have to get big enough, and they have to make enough pollen to leave a signature. Beetles get there in months, okay? So the beetles tell us that climate changes faster than the pollen tells us. Okay, so beetles and trees move at different rates, too. Okay, what's the take-home from all of this? The take-home is human beings are prone to think that whatever they grew up with is normal. And if it changes, that's abnormal, and it's freaky, and it's scary. But change is the norm, and stasis, clearly, is the exception. Okay? Communities are constantly changing and reformulating. Ecosystems are constantly changing. And some professional ecologists are coming to recognize that fact, as witness this recently published book, Novel Ecosystems. We're not going to make all our introduced species go away. And we're not going to recreate the communities that were here in 1492 or 1848 or whatever arbitrary year you pick, because the physical environment around them has changed and the pool of species available to colonize has changed. So we need to make the best of reality and stop, to use a snazzy intellectual word, stop reifying a community concept that is no longer relevant. To reify means to take something which is merely conceptual and treat it as if it were a thing. Okay, I'm done, but I will put up some references on the board in case people want to take some down. And I guess it's time for questions.
Our thanks to Dr. Shapiro for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Ecological Communities and the March of Time with Dr. Arthur Shapiro. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. Please keep your questions short and to the point. Also, please be sure that your questions are, in fact, questions and not statements. So we have two standing microphones here. If you have any questions, please line up behind one of these microphones and speaking to the microphone as we are recording. And also we can run a mic if you rather be seated and ask questions.
Can you hear me? Is this on?
It doesn't sound like it's on. Did everybody get the question?
No, we didn't hear it.
Okay, the question was, would I say something about the relationship of the monarch and its roosting trees, by which I assume you mean eucalyptus? If I dare say the word eucalyptus, people may have rotten tomatoes with them. Okay, eucalyptus, of course, is non-native. One of the very strange things about the monarch butterfly migration is that there is no history of it. There are apparently a couple of references as early as the 1860s. The Spaniards do not appear to have documented it at all or to have noticed it. To make things even stranger, there is no tradition of the monarch overwintering in Mexico. The local people in the area where the huge roosts are in Mexico didn't know they were there until gringos took them there. It's exceedingly strange. There is no role of the monarch in Mexican mythology. Other butterflies, yes. The monarch, no. Anyway, it's the lack of history which makes it difficult to interpret the monarch-eucalyptus relationship. It can't be co-evolved. It would be asymmetrical anyway and not true co-evolution because there's no evidence that the eucalyptus has done anything in response to the presence of the monarch. We know that monarchs can roost in conifers like Monterey pine. We know that in Mexico they roost in the OML fir. But we don't really know very much more. There is no hard evidence that they mark the trees so that they return to the same ones year after year. It's something of a mystery. What we can say is that if eucalyptus were not here, we don't have the vaguest idea what monarchs would be doing. Okay. Sorry, I can't tell you more. We just don't know. Yeah.
Thank you so much for speaking to us. I really appreciate the long-term thinking and the individual plants and come together in ecosystems at a certain time, and that's true. I wonder how you feel about stewardship and how we become sort of advocates for our natural systems in cities and,
Okay. I'll tell you what I tell my students when I teach about conservation biology, which is that conservation is a decision, is a choice, which is based on many things. It is informed by science, but it is not dictated by science. Conservation reflects values and priorities, which can be based on ethics, it can be based on religion, it can be based on secular philosophy, it can be based on whether you were breastfed. I don't know where an individual's commitment to conservation comes from. But all science can do is to give the conservation community data. And then the people who are in a position to implement conservation have to make the decision what is worth conserving and to what extent do we want to commit the resources to conserve it. Okay? So, personally, with reference to so-called restoration ecology, I think demonstration projects are wonderful. I was part of one on Staten Island, New York, which was sabotaged by a contractor who dumped a truckload of broken concrete into it and ruined it. But I've been involved in restoration myself. But I think that the notion of trying to restore community composition to what it was at some arbitrary date in the past, on any large scale as against on a small educational scale, is probably folly. Any such project is likely to be an exercise in gardening, specialty gardening, to the extent that the conditions that obtained when that desired community existed just aren't there anymore. Too many things have changed. So that's my own bias on that subject. And I admit freely that it is a bias. I'm suspicious of grand sweeping solutions. On the other hand, I would be very happy to see an experiment in recreating the passenger pigeon or even the woolly mammoth, as long as a herd of 200 million of them isn't loosed on the planet. I hope that helps. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you're views on these subjects have changed in the last 5 or 10 years, and if so, how they have evolved?
Well, as a few of you know, I happen to be the proprietor of the largest faunistic and phenological, pardon the jargon, database on butterflies in North America and one of the two largest in the world. We began monitoring whole butterfly faunas in the early 1970s. So we have this huge mountain of data for butterfly faunas along a transect from sea level to tree line, 10 stations, sampled every 2 weeks, weather permitting. And that enables us to say a lot about biotic responses to both climate change and land use. Okay? I would say that my views have changed to the extent that I have become aware of how land use change and climate change interact in altering faunas and ultimately communities. And what we have learned so far is that at low elevations near sea level, land use change rules, and at high altitudes, climate change rules. But that's just because there hasn't been much land use change at high altitudes yet. Okay? I don't think any of my basic perceptions have changed in the last 10 years, but what has changed is my ability to say anything definitive based on actual evidence, which is largely the result of statistical analysis of this mountain of data. So, in a nutshell, I've gotten more sophisticated. Okay?
Yes. Hello, Dr. Shapiro.
Hello, William.
Hi, thanks for coming.
Thank you for coming.
That you're in our county.
This gentleman here is the number one butterfly person in San Francisco.
Well,
butterflies
aside, Dr. Shapiro,
yes.
I'm sort of fascinated at, and I sort of see a chasm between some of your A plus B equaling C, and
okay.
I'm sort of interested. You say that we need to look back in order to learn.
Right.
But what I'm asking you is, how can we glean anything looking back at the models when our species is accelerating things so quickly that its acceleration is its own thing? You can't extrapolate or recognize anything looking back. Beetles and trees, what I don't understand is you're not factoring in that humans move trees.
I am. Actually, if you go back to the slide that shows the sequence of arrivals of trees in the UK, that doesn't include the ones that we know were human introduced. And that's very interesting because in most cases, the UK being the UK, we know that such and such an oak was brought in from France at such and such an abbey in 1248. And so we can quantify its rate of spread. So we do have data of that sort. But I think what you're probably driving at is that habitat fragmentation has severely restricted the potential mobility of organisms in tracking climate change. Is that what you're getting at?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Well, yes, it has, undoubtedly, although we don't have as much data as we would like. There is a great deal of discussion in the, dare I say, conservation community. There's that word. In the conservation community about effective corridors to allow for dispersal and about so-called assisted migration, where you actually take the things where they need to go. Now, that raises another issue, and I'm going to take 2 minutes to talk about it because I didn't include it in the actual talk. The usual approach that is followed is so-called niche modeling or bioclimatic envelope modeling. There are a number of different terms that apply basically the same approach, where you look at where a species is now. You try to quantify as precisely as possible the environmental parameters that define where it occurs. Then you take the climatic models and try to project where that climate will be in 50 years, 100 years, 150 years, given various assumptions about climate change. You then ask the question, can the species get there itself, or are we going to have to help it? The example I like to give my students is sugar maple. Most of you probably like maple syrup. Has anyone here ever invested in maple plantations in Vermont or New Hampshire? Well, don't, because according to this approach, the climatic envelope for sugar maple is going to shift up into northern Quebec and Labrador in 50 or 75 years. But there are two complications, and they're really important complications. One is ecotypes. Ecotypes, the word is actually on your handout. ecotypes are local ecological races. Everybody here knows ponderosa pine. A ponderosa pine from Placer County, California, and a ponderosa pine from Boulder, Colorado, look exactly the same. Their pollens are indistinguishable in the fossil record. But the one from Boulder needs summer rain. You try and plant seed from Colorado Front Range on the west slope of the Sierra, and the trees will all die because there's no summer rain. Those are ecotypes. They're genetically based natural selection products adapted to different climates. Okay? Because organisms can evolve ecotypes, it's entirely possible that we are grossly misunderstanding the potential range of species by looking at only where they are now. Okay? The second thing is, there can be no analog climates, just as there are no analog communities. That is to say, climates of the past and climates of the future can have combinations of characteristics that don't exist today, at least within the geographic purview of the species we're concerned about. Anybody here ever hike in the Trinity Alps? Okay. Well, you guys know that in the Trinity Alps, you get more and more frequent summer rain than you do in the Sierra Nevada. And the result is you get combinations of plants in the Trinity Alps that you would almost never find in the Sierra. They're communities, all right, but they're different communities because the climate is different. There will be climates in the future in which plants and animals can co-occur that can't now, just as there have been in the past, those big black dots. Okay? So we try to project the future, knowing that nature is actually more clever than we are. Okay, I hope that helps a little. Yeah.
I have followed with great interest and admiration your very articulate critique of restoration ecology. And in that context, I want to ask you a question that I also posed to your colleague Scott Carroll last month, and I hope you'll bear with me as I repeat the question. I live in the East Bay, and I'm involved in a campaign to try and block a project about which you probably have heard. It's a project put forward by UC Berkeley, East Bay Regional Parks District, and the City of Oakland to clear-cut hundreds of thousands of non-native trees over in this area over 2,000 acres and then apply massive amounts of pesticides. Mm-hmm. The project has been cloaked in fire hazard mitigation language, but so far the propagators of the project have declined to consider more or less extreme approaches to fire hazard. The focus on non-native, so-called invasive tree species has drawn the support of the native plant advocates, and this has split the environmental community. Our group is opposing the project partly because many of us are chemically injured and cannot be exposed to pesticides. My own disability is the direct result of exposure to herbicides. But we're encountering tremendous opposition and fervor, and it's heating up. The battle is heating up, and the positions are becoming increasingly polarized. Just recently, the Sierra Club wrote a letter to East Bay Regional Park District in which it articulated a position supporting the project and, in fact, advocating an even more hardline approach to the clear cut, and expressed no opposition to the use of this massive use of pesticides, which the proponents of the project plan to use for up to 10 years. Our position is that we have a right to access those public lands, and pesticides will violate our right under the Americans with Disabilities Act to access those lands. But we're encountering so much hostility that I wonder if you could comment on, if you could perhaps advise us as to what direction you think we might go.
In effect, I've already tried to answer that question implicitly. That is to say, science can only inform. The decision is essentially political, which is to say, whatever your position on the matter, in a democracy, this is not Turkey where Twitter is being suppressed, this is not Russia where Pussy Riot is being put in jail. You have a right to express yourself by any lawful means, to pursue any legal remedies available to you, to make use of all the techniques that have been so brilliantly perfected in this society for public persuasion. The use of targeted marketing techniques, of focus groups, of advertising methods. You know who the most important American of the 20th century was? His name was Ed Bernays. Has anyone here ever heard of him? Ed Bernays was the man who invented those techniques in advertising. He also happened to be a relative of Sigmund Freud. At any rate, persuasion, political and legal action are the answer to your question. Science can inform, but it cannot decide. Okay? Yeah.
Thank you for your comments. I was wondering if you might reflect on the implications for human ecology. And I guess you sort of already have.
Yeah. Well, I say on the handout, the King Canute should get lost. Remember what King Canute did? He stood there to demonstrate his omnipotence by commanding the tide to go away, and it didn't. And ultimately, King Canute had to go away. We are not going to reverse ecological and geologic processes that are on a scale way beyond our control and way beyond our understanding. We have to have the wisdom to recognize where and when action is appropriate. And we have to have the wisdom to recognize how to prioritize our actions, because our resources are anything but unlimited. That is to say, to use that lady's example, the investment of money and labor in clear-cutting eucalyptus could be devoted to something else. The question is there a something else which is a more important, more pressing problem to which that money should be applied? Now, I realize money comes in earmarked pots. We have that in the University of California budget all the time. There always seems to be lots of money for administration and not that much for teaching. But we have to prioritize. We can't do everything, and we have to think about the scale on which things can reasonably be done. Okay, that's about all I can say. Yeah, next.
Hi.
Anybody who has to go, please go out. I won't be offended. Yes.
I want to go back to fire danger.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you have any personal feelings about the human intervention to try to protect homes from fire by cutting massive amounts of trees and using herbicides?
Well, I'm not an expert in fire ecology. I know a lot about the population dynamics of a few fire-dependent or fire-related species like knobcone pine and McNab cypress. But I don't really have the professional bona fides to give you a response to that as anything but an ordinary citizen. So I will follow the advice of the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said in German, when you don't know anything, shut up. Okay, next. Hi, Clint.
Great presentation, Art.
Thank you.
it seems to me, along with your data set, is unprecedented with the length of time that you've collected all of that information. We should be doing more of that for a whole variety of species. In my tromping around lowland California, I've noticed increases in non-native grasses, but I don't remember what was there prior, if they were there or if they've just all of a sudden increased it. And so I think there should be an emphasis. Yeah.
Monitoring and so-called citizen science are in vogue right now. Historically, it was never possible unless you had an angel, unless you seduced an old widow and got her to give you control of her finances. You did not have the opportunity to get an ongoing endowment to support a project like mine. Okay? Given the current situation with climate change, granting agencies are paying more attention to this sort of thing. But funding is still on short cycles. And it's not only difficult, but it's very painful to start a monitoring project and then have the funding yanked out so it has to be ended prematurely. Okay? You can get short-term funding from crowdsource funding sources like experiment.com or even Kickstarter. But we need to get longer-term commitments. And again, there is a question of prioritization. Is it necessary for us to monitor populations of pigeons at the Powell Street turnaround for the cable cars? I'm not sure whether any useful information comes out of that. Where do we want to monitor? How do we prioritize our monitoring, our allocation of resources? Those are important questions. The granting agencies are getting interested, and there is a lot of activity in citizen science, and there is a lot of activity right now. Have you heard of Jonathan Silvertown? Jonathan Silvertown is at the Open University in UK. And he is the founder of a massive citizen science project which so far is operating in the UK and in South Africa. I'm trying to remember what it's called. It's iSomething. Anyway, if you Google him, you will get the information. And they have a very novel approach. They want to minimize the amount of misinformation put out by citizen volunteers who are not experts in their group. So they have online tests, and they test your skill, and you can earn points to get a higher rating so that your identifications get higher credibility. This is the right way to go, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, anyway, there's a hell of a lot of interest in this sort of thing, and there's plenty of going on in the Bay Area, too. So by all means, if you would like to get involved in such projects, it's particularly good for retired folks who are still spry and active and can go out there with their binoculars and their field guides. Okay? So, go for it. Next.
We'll take two more questions, and then if you have any questions, Dr. Shapiro will be available.
Okay. Go ahead.
About the march of time and education and politics and students and your view, I'm wondering how long you think it will take before your view makes it into other universities. Thus far, restoration ecology has moved from our college to our community college to our high schools to our preschools, and now kids are spending weekends out tearing up ice plant off of dunes. And I'm just wondering what you think about how the knowledge or the opinion changes through time.
Well, you know, the politics of this is exceedingly interesting. I have to be very careful because when I give a talk like this, I open myself up to being accused of being a tool of the extractive industries, a tool of the chemical companies, you name it. I'm not a tool of anybody, ladies and gentlemen, not even my wife. But the fact is that when you get into these sensitive issues, it becomes very tricky. Some of you may subscribe online to the newsletter of the National Center for Science Education, NCSE. Anybody here know it? Okay, they are essentially a volunteer group that combats both creationism and climate change denial in education and in public affairs. Okay? One has to be very, very careful to phrase one's words so that one can't have them twisted to misrepresent what one is really saying. I'm not saying that I want to see all our redwoods cut down because successional forests have higher biodiversity than redwood, even though that's true. Okay? I am saying that if you're a butterfly person, fire and logging are your friend because butterflies don't like continuous forest canopies. Okay. Be careful what you say. And if you are careful about it and you advance it in the right ways, it will penetrate. Okay. Yeah.
San Francisco is putting together a biodiversity action plan. It states that a healthier local ecosystem is more resistant to invasive species, and the health of these ecosystems depends on conservation of native plants, animals, and so forth, and their ecosystems. Is this true? Does better health for ecosystems depend on conservation of native plants?
Well, there's a lot of conventional wisdom in that statement, and some of it's true and some of it's not true, and a lot of it is case dependent. Okay, let's go back to Gleason. All right? You remember the Monty Python song, Every Sperm is Sacred? Well, I don't know if every sperm is sacred, but every species and every situation has to be approached from the standpoint of the facts on the ground rather than dogma. I've been asked occasionally, what are you politically? And I say, I am a disciple of Isaiah Berlin. Anybody here? And that's not the guy who wrote White Christmas. Anybody here know who Isaiah Berlin was? Okay. Why am I a disciple of Isaiah Berlin, do you think? Well, I love the idea behind the fox and hedgehog thing, which is Berlin basically spent his entire career arguing that any ideology carried to its logical limit leads to absurdity, if not tragedy. Okay? That's just as true for native plant advocacy as it is for let's rip up the planet. I still remember the bumper sticker playing on Earth First years ago that said, Earth First, we'll log the other planets later. Okay. Any more? Okay, thank you very much, folks.
Our thanks to Dr. Shapiro for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.